Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And today we actually have our first double guests on our show. We have Kendall Hanks and Kristen Lafreniere, otherwise known as KVP in the past, but her new married name. And we have them both on today to join us to talk about several topics. So, ladies, the way that I got to know both of you was through Twitter, and I think both of you have a pretty big presence on there. We're going to talk about that a lot today. But for those of us that don't follow you on Twitter, can you kind of just tell us a little bit about your background, each of you, and kind of how you came to be where you are in your career and what you're doing today?
Sure. Kristen and I have actually done this before together, and so she's probably going to hear some of the same stories. I actually got dragged to Twitter kicking and screaming. I was not a fan of social media. I'm not on Facebook, very limited other social media platforms. Twitter, I joined because I was doing a presentation for the American Bar Association business law section up in Washington, D.C., a panel on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think that year we had Neil Kochel or maybe Adam Liptak, but Bloomberg was there covering the panels, like a 2.5 hour panel. And as soon as I got out, one of my partners said, "Oh, did you see Bloomberg is live tweeted your whole panel?" I was like, "Oh, all right, fine. Now I have to get on Twitter." And so I got on Twitter and, you know, I responded to a couple, you know, "Thanks, this is great. You know, it was great to see everybody." And all of a sudden there were all these people I knew from appellate practice, you know, in New York, in Texas. We've all seen that Texas appellate lawyers have quite a presence on Twitter and appellate Twitter in particular. And it just sort of went from there. So I'm really glad that I ended up kind of getting drug into Twitter, but it certainly was not necessarily voluntary.
What about you, Kristen? Tell us your Twitter story.
Well, I got on Twitter quite a while ago when I was still an undergrad and did a lot with organizations and political and otherwise getting people involved and live tweeting and things like that of events. But when I decided to go to law school and started plugging in with other lawyers, I'm the first lawyer in my family. And so I kind of had to reach out to folks and try to find mentors and such. And Twitter kind of became that for me. And then particularly, I guess, second year of law school, when I started getting very interested in appellate practice, like Kendall said, there were already so many appellate lawyers on Twitter that would give advice or offer to look at moots and help me with even moot court competitions and such. So it was a pretty seamless transition from law school into appellate practice for me. And it's great that the Texas sort of legion that we seem to have of so many of our appellate lawyers, but also just across the nation, people who are willing to chime in and help and just really be that resource is just awfully unique, I think.
Kristen, you actually spent a year kind of working for the ultimate appellate tweeter himself, Don Willett, when he was on the Supreme Court.
I did. I tell people that I think that's part of how I got the job, both as his intern and as his post-grad law clerk, because I already had a Twitter and I liked all of his dad jokes, but I don't know how true that is.
So, Kendall, I know you're in Austin now, but you were in New York originally. Is that where you started your practice?
I actually started my practice in Austin in 2001, which a time that feels very familiar to right now, actually, because it was a huge downturn, really tumultuous time in the profession. And I practiced here for 2 years, and then I went to Dallas for 2 years, and then I was in New York for 7. And then I came back home. Most of my family is here. I guess it was, 7 years ago. So
You've been back home in Austin now for as long as you were in New York. So that, exactly. That's gotta feel good.
It does. Time flies though. Wow.
And Kristen, you're back in your hometown of Lubbock. Is that right?
That's right. I was raised here and then spent a year in Austin working for then Justice Willett, now Judge Willett, and then came home to practice. So I'm still here.
Ladies, one of the reasons we asked y'all to be on here, one of many reasons, is there's kind of the Lady Lawyer Diaries Twitter platform has gotten a lot of news, and you guys have become a great voice for women practicing law, I think both in appeals and out of appeals. Todd and I recognize the limits of our perspectives here. We're both two boring dudes who do appellate law, and nobody really wants to hear from us. So we kind of wanted to give y'all a platform to talk about. Oh, and there is Kendall's dog.
She's
popping in.
Molly. Not getting enough attention.
Molly.
A lot of people know Molly.
Molly.
Hi, Molly.
She's pawing at me because I'm not paying attention to her. So
that's just what this podcast needed. More.
Absolutely.
Well, a lot of people know Molly from Twitter. So little appearance there. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's great. We're glad to have her on the show. If she has anything she wants to add, tell her to feel free.
Right.
Well, put up a picture.
See, it's your first triple guest now.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. So far, we haven't had any animal guests that I have seen, at least. I mean, there's not someone here.
That's a great point that Jody just made, though. I mean, let's face it. He and I mean, you can't get any more, you know, white male than the two of us. And if you want to add old white male to the mix, then I guess I qualify as that. But
I'm not quite ready to admit that I do, but I'll go with uncomfortably middle-aged, perhaps.
So I mean, I certainly, having seen what y'all are doing on Twitter, you know, I don't want to say enjoy reading the Lady Lawyer Diary stuff, because I have to say, y'all, I feel some very large pangs of old white guy guilt whenever I read that stuff. And frankly, it's a lot of it is just flat shocking to me that people actually behave that way in this world. But you know, for those who aren't familiar, I probably ought to preface that comment by saying that some of what that hashtag involves, perhaps most of it, is tales, almost horror stories from the woman's perspective of what it's like to be a practicing attorney in a world that's dominated by middle-aged or largely older white males. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I think it is.
I think that's at least how it started, as a way to bring together. One thing I would add, though, is that we really do enjoy using the hashtag as, yes, a way to let people know they can be heard, but also as a way of really supporting and encouraging other ladies and lady lawyers and lady professionals in a way that really gives kudos to their accolades or their professional accomplishments. And so it's not just a negative thing. It's not just horror stories. It's a really positive avenue for us to be able to broadcast good thing that lady lawyers are doing. But yes, I think a good chunk of, at least maybe at the beginning and even maybe still now, is guess what I was asked when I walked into the courtroom today, and I'm the only person. I wonder if what's different about me than everybody else in the courtroom this morning. Oh, what do you know? It's just that I was the only woman. So,
well, I don't mean to minimize at all the positives that come out of it, aside from obviously supporting each other, you know, through some rather difficult situations. It is clear that there is a big mentorship angle that's being played out in that hashtag and all the discussions. I just mean that the things that really stuck out and really, to be honest, bothered me were the things, the stories that came out of the things that you, like you just described, Kristen, you know, where it was clearly, it's just obvious that the reason why, you know, the person in the room was being treated differently was because she happened to be female. And,
right.
You know, do you find, I'll just ask the question, and maybe the answer is obvious, but I'll ask it anyway, is do you find being a younger female lawyer that you are treated differently than perhaps even a more seasoned female attorney?
I think that's probably true. Certainly, I think there's obstacles to just being female, period. Although I think maybe just depending even on the region, some of that is obviated and folks work on it. But I do think there's probably a little bit more as well towards a young woman, someone who even often looks, you know, younger than your age, or perhaps you're petite, or whatever it is that, you know, could be a physical characteristic of a younger lady lawyer, can very much be treated. I'll back up to say some of it is obvious sexism and folks who just are purposefully being misogynistic, but most of it's not, right? Most of it is pretty unconscious bias of just, you're just being the Southern gentleman, so it's okay if I call you darling and everybody else mister, right? It may not be intended to be demeaning, but that doesn't mean that it's not. And so some things you just have to learn to brush off because it doesn't help your client, and you just got to move on, which is no different than if you have an obnoxious opposing counsel or an unreasonable judge, regardless of whether, you know, what your gender or your age. Sometimes you just have to deal with being treated unreasonably because that's what's best for your client. But yeah, I think there probably are a few more hurdles to jump when you're a young woman or just a lady lawyer.
Todd, one of the things you mentioned earlier is that you were sort of surprised by some of the stories that you heard through Lady Lawyer Diaries. And I think that connects actually to the reason and the way that we set up the handle. You know, the hashtag, which was, I think, first used by Rachel Gervich, who's a law professor, former big law, like a really talented woman lawyer. She started using it as a hashtag and we were all using it. And it really started to balloon. But one of the things that we noticed was, you know, most of us, I mean, Kristen and I certainly tweet under our own names. We're not anonymous. And a lot of the women colleagues that we work with and talk to and who we had interacted with on Twitter also did the same, or they were sort of semi-public. And what we noticed is there were huge conversations going on offline because people were worried about information being attributed to them. And so we were hearing war stories and sharing experiences, but we couldn't share it on the platform out of concern for protecting people's, you know, anonymity. And so Lady Lawyer Diaries, we set it up as an anonymous handle. I mean, some of us have, I mean, Kristen and I have been associated with it from the beginning, and so has Jamie Santos and Rachel and a number of others. There are some others who are involved who aren't publicly associated, but who help us in the background. But it gives us the ability, you know, to create a platform for people to reach out to us privately and share those experiences. And so we've been able to get those stories out in a way that a lot of people really are hearing some of this stuff for the first time, because women are terrified to speak about those things publicly. So, and I will tell you, as one of the people who administers the handle, we get private messages that are sometimes so concerning that we encourage the people who reached out not to speak about it publicly. And we assist them in making the right connections to either law enforcement or to, you know, a proper reporting agency. So as bad as some of the stories you've heard on Lady Lawyer Diaries, I assure you there are worse. And they're not uncommon, unfortunately. They're not.
And that's, you know, that's the thing that is just so horrifying about all of it, is how frequently they happen. And particularly just seeing the ones where people just publicly on social media, some of the things that they post in response to some of these things is just shocking. I mean, under their own names, the attitudes that people have just out there in the world, it always amazes me, and not in a good way.
We're sort of used to it, you know, like the hysterical lady brain, like we made mugs out of that. Like, you know, like fine, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the Lady Lawyer Diaries, we have coffee mugs and t-shirts. So
yes, you know. We do. But that's the thing, the really great thing about Twitter that I never expected. This is how I met Kristen, and Kristen and I have become good friends. And I can say the same about a lot of other women lawyers from around the country, frankly, not even just in this country, but in other countries. There is a bonding experience when women share their stories and realize how not alone they really are. And I've been practicing for 20 years now, and I will say that it's only the last couple with this experience that I'd sort of heard stories here and there, and, oh yeah, you know, this sort of thing has happened to me before. I don't think even I even really appreciated how prevalent and how universal these experiences were. you know, being stalked, being, yeah, you wouldn't believe the messages we get on DMs and Twitter pictures that we get on Twitter. I mean, it's astonishing. And that is not a unique experience, but women are trained not to talk about those things. And so the consequence of that is that these things happen, but because people are discouraged from talking about it, at least historically, very little gets done because it's treated like it doesn't really happen that often. And I think that's changing. And I think that's a good thing.
And it kind of seems like timing wise, this has gone well to time itself at the same time as kind of the Me Too movement. I don't want to put you in that same box, but you know, just nationally, even internationally, there's a lot more people encouraging women to speak out and, you know, giving them credibility when they come forward with those accounts. And I mean, it seems like this is a good thing to be able to build off of that too.
I think we've definitely been able, as a community and our handle and hashtag in particular, been able to find a lot more allies because of the Me Too movement, find people who are willing to talk, find allies who are willing to back those up and hear those stories. And I think one of the best things, and kind of strange, I suppose, because of sort of how a lot of folks see social media and Twitter as this, just, I'm going to put something out there and I'll feel better because I kind of put it out into the internet, right? Is this particular community has really become a, we're going to listen to your story. This is a place where you can speak and yes, you feel better because you put it out there, but then you're also going to get kind of that backup and encouragement in a really encouraging way that a lot of times social media doesn't really give you the ability to do. And that's been something that's been particularly encouraging, which I think has also helped us move from not always just kind of those war stories, but also allowing us to be able to grow as a community of, let's also really broadcast each other's accomplishments, because here we now have this platform where we can do that in a way that a lot of our male colleagues feel free to do themselves. For whatever reason, often female professionals do not. Mm-hmm. It's easier for other people to share those things. And so it's given us that ability to be that platform, which is really encouraging use of social media, which is not a sentence that is said very often, I don't think.
You know, absolutely. And I've kind of always said, just from personal experience, that the group of people that's related to Appellate Twitter, we're really lucky to have that little corner of Twitter, because that's not the norm for Twitter users to find a small supportive group that actually wants to listen to one another.
I think that's true.
You know, another thing that I've kind of seen going on is that, you know, you guys are, and I mean this more collectively than just the two of you, but you really are engaging in some systemic change. I mean, there was a lot of talk, particularly with the things that went on in the federal judiciary and them trying to rewrite the rules. I know a lot of people associated with y'all and with Twitter and all that had a lot of input on some of those things and a lot of opinions. And it seems like that may have helped influence some of the debate and discussions around that.
I mean, there are some remarkable women leaders on Twitter who are approaching complicated and difficult issues in very productive ways. Jamie Santos, of course, who is an appellate lawyer in Washington, she's the one who testified at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing concerning revision to the rules regarding sexual harassment and reporting. And Alyssa Leader, who, I mean, everything from law students to women lawyers who have been practicing for 25, 30 years, I mean, it is a remarkable cross-section of women lawyers from around the country who are openly tackling incredibly difficult issues that, frankly, in, you know, earlier in my career, it was sort of like, please don't rock the boat. Please don't make things complicated. And even when that was said with the best of intention, it's an insidious thing, because those experiences, those patterns really get repeated and they get embedded in a culture. And I think this ability to publicly talk about it, and frankly, the fact that our firms sort of support that. I mean, they, you know, there's, I don't believe for one instant that everybody who reads my Twitter feed is super thrilled to agree with everything I say, but that's totally fine. And it's a big deal that the people we work with professionally support those voices, because the chilling of voices in the interest of not rocking the boat is part of the problem. So what are some of the other groups, Kristen? There's Me Too US Courts. There's, of course, Strict Scrutiny, which is a group of really amazing women who talk about the U.S. Supreme Court. But it's not just about that. Like they're also talking about, you know, issues that affect women and women in the appellate practice, which is fantastic. Women Who Know Law. I mean, you know, there's some groups that are quick to, we get in trouble for this all the time. People get very upset when we point out manholes, but we do. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, this is, all of us have been sort of the one woman on a panel of six men, and we've all been to panels that have all been men with, you know, no lawyers of color. And in this modern practice, there's just no excuse for it anymore. And I think that the efforts that a lot of groups, not just us, but a lot of lawyers and a lot of groups who are outspoken about it, the efforts to change people's mindset from a passive mindset, well, I was invited, I didn't have any control over it, there wasn't anything I could do, to an active mindset of, if I'm going to participate in something, I'm going to expect it to reflect the diversity that is important to me. And it's been great seeing, you know, I've seen guys on social media say, hey, I was invited to this panel. It was a really great panel with some interesting people. And I said, I'm not going to participate unless I see diversity on this panel. That's the kind of change that needs to come. It can't just come from women. It has to come from law firms. It has to come from clients, from colleagues, from men, from white men, you know. I mean, really, because those power structures, I think now that we're starting to see more buy-in to the notion that diversity is important for, you know, culturally, but it's also important for our clients, for our firms, you know, for the way we practice law. I mean, there's still so much further to go, obviously. And the pay gap is insane for women. You know, we still have small numbers in terms of firm leaderships nationally and equity partners, you know, for lawyers of color and women. But I would like to think we're part of a positive change. I mean, Kristen, you're still relatively new to this. So I don't know. What do you think about all this? Maybe I'm just jaded.
And I don't think you are. I think one of the biggest things that I saw maybe coming into it as a law student and sort of the community growing as I joined the practice, but having met so many of y'all, even Jody, you and I met, I think, when I was still in law school. And so many of those just becoming colleagues kind of let me have a little bit of a better viewpoint. I'm lucky in that I'm in, you know, a smaller firm that really values what I'm doing and really supports that, but I'm still the only female at my firm, right? So there's even with my colleagues who are very meticulous and make sure that they stay on top of stuff, they're still, because it's such an unconscious bias that really permeates our society, even when folks are trying to stay on top of stuff, there's still things that you pull people aside and say, you can't say stuff like that, or this is how that sounded. Let's repeat that back and make you realize, you know, how that sounded. Let's not say that again. And that's from folks who are working at it, right? And we're all working on it. And I think that's one of the most positive things for me is that this little microcosm of lady lawyers or appellate Twitter and a lady lawyer within appellate Twitter is allowing me to see, okay, these are the types of unconscious biases that affect me. Now, what are mine that affect, you know, that next kind of circle? What's that next circle of lawyers of color or women of color or whatever that next thing is that help me, and that folks then will private message me and say, hey, I saw you say this thing. I don't think you meant it wrong, but here's how that felt as a woman of color. And then I can learn. And we can just treat that as a learning experience. And I just think it's particularly helpful outside of the lens of lady lawyers or anything of that. I think we tend to get very much in our own echo chambers, whether we're talking politically or just our own friends or our family or whatever that reason is. And because of that, it can feel very isolating if you feel like you're the only one who's experiencing that thing. That's true about what we've been talking about. I think that's true about imposter syndrome, that all of us probably experience in our jobs or any professional experiences or any young person or older person or whatever. And this is a kind of minute example of how that helps that imposter syndrome that everybody has. And I think that's one of the reasons that it has had such a wide effect outside of just a Texas lady lawyers or appellate lawyers in Texas, because everybody kind of sees that community and realizes, oh, I'm not the only one that's happening to. And you have such a much larger, broader way of using this social media platform in a way to realize you're not alone, as sort of naive as possibly that sounds, just sometimes just knowing, you know what, you're not the only one who's experienced that thing. It's too bad both of us have, but at least you're not alone. So I think that's true across a lot of different variables. This is just a good example of how that happens.
Sure.
You know, I just to echo what she just said, a phrase popped into my head, and I don't know if I've ever used it before, but I've certainly thought about it a lot. There is empowerment in community. And there are a lot of things about law practice that impede community. I mean, we have bar organizations and all that stuff, and that's great. But we have, you know, law firms where we all go and work. And then within law firms, we have practice groups where we spend most of our time with. And I think one of the things social media does is that it really just sort of blows right past those, you know, geographic practice community barriers and creates a whole new community. Appellate Twitter is like that too. And I don't know if something like that ever would have been possible before. I mean, even having been involved in leadership of the American Bar Association, those communities were limited to people who were real bar people, you know, who were going to the meetings, you know, across the country and stuff. And that's that in itself is an impediment. So I think there's real opportunities that are still being explored. And there's a lot more that we want to do. I mean, we get busy. It's hard to keep up with the handle, particularly now that we've got, I don't even know where we are right now. You know, but we have families and lives and practices, and so we're constantly thinking about how we continue to grow this community in a way that is, that's, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, how do you keep up with, you know, 10,000 women from around the country?
Sure.
So it's a remarkable, wonderful, wonderful thing, and it's a new horizon, and I love it. But that empowerment has been something that I don't think I can really articulate what a difference it's made for me in my own personal life and my professional life.
And when it all started, you probably couldn't have imagined that this would be where it would go.
Never.
And Twitter is kind of a unique medium, you know, for this. You think about the other media that are out there, it's hard to imagine something like this developing in like a Facebook page or a LinkedIn group or something like that. I mean, Twitter is just so accessible and easy to get in and out of. And I'll also mention, you know, in terms of not only the mentorship aspect for the women that participate in this, I mean, you are having an impact, because all of the names that you rattled off a little while ago, Kendall, I've seen all those names show up in my Twitter feed, and I'll sometimes dig deeper and say, oh, you know, I don't know this person personally, but someone I know is talking about them or having a conversation with them, and it looks interesting. And so I'll delve into it a little deeper. And that's usually when I get, and I find the things that I'm like, oh my gosh, this really happened. You know, that's not always the fire that lights a conversation within that group. But, you know, because of these activities, it's kind of building, the conversations build on each other and sort of permeate. And before you know it, you're reaching people that, you know, maybe weren't the original intended audience for these discussions, but it's having an impact. Because as I say, you know, me, here in Austin, not knowing Rachel or Jamie or Alyssa personally, I certainly have an appreciation for who they are, and maybe a better idea than I ever would have before for issues that they have had to deal with as female lawyers. And so it's definitely far reaching in a way that probably wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago.
Yeah. I love hearing that. And I think the way we think about the handle and what it accomplishes has evolved. And part of that is understanding that our audience is not just the women who actively participate in the handle. Our audience is law firms, it's clients, it's you guys, because you know, we have these conversations offline. We know what's going on, right? But the ability to use this platform in a safe way for women to share their stories in a public forum so that people hear these stories, so people see how many women share those experiences, and frankly, the crazy trolls who come after women on our handle. Very rarely do we block those. I mean, very rarely. And the reason for that is because it is important for people to see the kinds of things that women deal with in this practice and in social media. So, you know, some wackadoodle guy from somewhere, you know, I'm not going to throw out any names, comes after some of the women in our community, or you know, joins into a conversation in a really toxic way with you know, with Lady Lawyer Diaries or something like that. That is important for you guys to see, because that's the kind of stuff that normally happens over email or private conversations or in a meeting. And people don't realize, like, this is the kind of stuff that we deal with regularly. So there is value in that, as frustrating as it can be sometimes.
Well, and it really exposes the systemic level and some of the systemic problems that give rise to these things. I mean, certainly you're always going to have people who are jerks, and you're going to have judges who behave badly, law partners who behave badly. But when you start to see it on that level aggregated, you can really see where the flaws in the system are that need to be fixed, that allows this type of thing to occur with the frequency and, you know, geographic variation that it does.
Well, one thing we wondered, and we are, you know, we're going a little beyond the time that we would usually record, because this is an important topic and because we do have two guests today. So, you know, we can keep going for a bit longer. But one of the things that we wanted to ask you about was, you know, what can lawyers generally, judges or bar associations, and I'm really plugged into the bar association angle of this, what can we do to make practice better, you know, for women and for law students? Are there any particular educational strategies, or, I mean, is there not a silver bullet, I guess, is what I would ask?
I don't know that there's a silver bullet. I think there's a lot of resources out there that, frankly, Twitter is sometimes a pretty good resource for. I think bar associations and local or otherwise would do well, and something that we're seeing sort of across the board nationally is something Kendall mentioned a while ago, is ensuring that you're really working on diversity at panels. I think even just the topics of panels, I think mindfulness, and I've seen several over the last few months and last couple of years especially, that are very much on, let's talk about implicit and unconscious biases in the legal community, and let's just have a frank discussion about those. Let's do kind of what y'all are doing right now, on a little bit of a broader scale, on lots of different types of topics, be that, you know, racial or gender or any of the above. I think that's something that's very helpful. I think law student and law school wise, I'm 4 years out at this point, but I'm still very plugged into Texas Tech and do a lot with them. I think it's always that one angle that could be such a great resource to use the law students who have a lot of great ideas about this. They're seeing things and experiencing things differently than even those of us who are pretty quickly out of law school. It's just a different perspective that I think we often don't really tap that resource with, and we could. They have very up-to-date information and ideas. I think we should be utilizing them as bar associations, not just inviting them, but inviting them to speak, inviting them to help with programming, and plugging into often, you know, law, be it law review CLEs or whatever, us plugging into those law school-wise as well, because often those diversity panels or those free CLEs or perhaps conferences that law reviews and such will put on for their students are actually more inclusive, more diverse, and more sort of up-to-date topics. And our local bar membership could actually really benefit from those, because they put a lot into it and they have a lot at stake. So I think even just more communication is sort of glib as that can sound, I think there's a lot of resources out there. We just need to connect A with B in a lot of situations. It's less coming up with new topics and more figuring out that these folks are there to talk about it. We just need to give them a microphone.
Makes sense.
Right.
I mean, my suggestion would be, I mean, I agree there's no silver bullet. There never is going to be. I mean, it is, these are ingrained cultural things about the way women are perceived in society and women in power are perceived. But what I was talking about earlier, being an active participant in discussions about and advocacy for diversity, racial diversity, gender diversity, sexual orientation. I mean, political diversity, frankly. I mean, Kristen and I, there's a lot of things we don't agree on, but there are a lot more important things that we do agree on. So, you know, panels, ask about diversity. Who's going to be on the panel? Most of the men I know now, who I know well, are kind of embarrassed when they sit down on a panel of six white men. And that's just, there's just no excuse for that anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, be proactive about that. One of the things we see a lot in law firms, and I know some women in-house and in academia experience this as well, don't fill your diversity committees with women and minorities. Don't put them in the supporting role. Don't make them responsible entirely for making diversity happen. You know, I mean, think about when they're invited into power or to committees or to leadership, what is it that you're asking them to do? I mean, are you asking them to support the structure that is there? Are you asking them to be the one that take notes, you know, literally or metaphorically? Are you asking them to be the one who's going to be doing all the legwork to make the group look good? You know, because we see a lot of women and, you know, and lawyers of color sort of shuttled into those roles, those sort of supporting roles. I mean, diversity has to be something that everyone who walks in the door has to appreciate, that it's not just important to diverse people. It's important to every single person in the room. I think that means, whether it's on social media, if it's at a lunch, if you see someone make a racist joke or a sexist joke, you know, that may not be directed at you. It may not feel like it's directed at you, but it is directed at you if it's something that you care about. And so say something about it. If you see, you know, a guy really, I mean, there's a lot of trolls, you know, 90% of it, you just, whatever, this person is an idiot, and it's self-evident. But sometimes it goes much further beyond that. Mm-hmm. And we see the people on social media, the men who stand up and say, you know what, that is not appropriate. That's not okay. And here's why. Because if you just have a chorus of women responding and explaining why something isn't okay, then what you see are the secondary trolls, which are the ones who are like, oh, great, like the coven is unleashed, that kind of thing.
Gosh.
So it can't just be women's voices. It can't just be voices of lawyers of color. It needs to be the whole of the community, that if we care about it, all of us are speaking about it. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be afraid to speak up. And it's been a really crazy year. We probably haven't been as good at sort of monitoring the regular chatter that's going on with the Lady Lawyer Diaries handle. But I will tell you that we try really hard to pay attention to and to acknowledge, publicly acknowledge and show gratitude for men who stand up for women in social media, because we want to encourage that behavior. Because if it's just us, then it's just a women's issue. And I think that's the thinking that really needs to change.
Right. Well, we want to respect your time. Y'all have been so gracious to spend this time with us today. And I could listen to you talk about this for much longer
than
we have available. It's great to hear it from the sources. Honestly, I can read about it on Twitter, but this is way, way better. I look forward to this episode going public and hopefully helping to continue the discussion, you know, riffing off of that. And maybe we'll get some social media traction about your discussion, and it'll continue to contribute to the conversation, I hope. One of the things that we like to do is ask our guests to share a tip or a war story. And I want to invite each of you to do that. It doesn't have to be anything super personal, because I know that it could be. I'm sure you have a lot that you could share. And I thought about the fact that, you know, this is the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, so I figured we'd give bonus points if your war story related to appeals and something to do with appellate. What do you think?
Kristen, you want to go?
Oh, I would say probably the best that I have are the three appellate cases that I've picked up from appellate Twitter followers who have specifically sent clients. And I've had folks that I didn't know call the office and say, someone told me to hashtag hire KVP for this appeal.
I love it.
That was great. No, that was probably my favorite is just that it all just goes back to that community of, you know, I try to obviously refer out clients that I can't help to folks, and it's easier to do locally with your local bar association. But our pretty special group of specialty Texas appellate lawyers who really can refer that out. And then with that, especially me as a young lawyer, who that always turns into, by the way, does anyone have a Word document of a Fifth Circuit brief that you could send me that I can work off of for a form? And y'all are always great for that too. But yeah, the client who questioningly asked if this was the right way to say hashtag hire KVP is probably my favorite.
Pound sign. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man, you know, I just laugh because there's so many funny stories. Funny ones, good ones, scary ones. I think that I think one of the best stories I've got, frankly, is, I don't know, frankly, the best story I have to share in this forum is the one that we've already shared. I mean, there are, in the very relatively few years that I've been on Twitter, I mean, some of these people have been on for like, you know, a decade, 15 years. I've probably been on for four or five. And, I mean, among my very closest friends now are women I've gotten to know and lawyers I've gotten to know through Twitter. And that sounds like I say it out loud and it kind of sounds a little pitiful, but it's really not, because these are not just friends on the platform. Mm-hmm. These are people I've gone on road trips with and, you know, visited in their homes. And I mean, we literally, two of us drove to Lubbock and visited Kristen and her mom.
That's right.
And her
that's
dog.
Awesome. Yeah, that's
and,
great.
Yeah. So I think that everyone needs to be careful on social media. Everyone needs to not get lulled into too much vulnerability on social media about what you say, to whom you say it. But I think that there are real, genuine connections to be made there. Business relationships, like Kristen's talking about now. I've sent you clients, Kristen. Yeah, I mean, I've gotten referrals because of my profile, but real community, like real connections, real friendships. And right now with everything that's going on in the universe, that's a pretty wonderful thing to have. So I'm pretty grateful for that.
It's just sort of ironic that something like Twitter can lead to actual real life human connection.
That's how Todd and I started this podcast.
It's true.
It's fantastic. I love it.
It's true. Yeah. So, well,
I'm going to add an extra story and you can cut it out if you want.
But no.
I think my new favorite story is the super fun timeline of appellate Twitter watching the live stream of my wedding. And all of y'all talking to each other during my wedding has to be one of my favorite parts, because I went back and looked at it later. And it's Jody and Kimball and Raffi and so many other people like, can you guys hear the audio of this? Oh, look, she's got a great hat on. I love that. So that's a pretty unique thing that will be a great story forever, too.
I don't know if you're the first Twitter wedding, but you have to be one of the few Twitter live streamed weddings, and certainly one of the first ones in the whole lockdown quarantine time.
That is a great story. And I think that's a perfect place to finish up for today. So,
and actually, Todd, before we close, we've talked about Twitter a lot. Why don't each of you give your Twitter handles, since we've gotten all this out here? I don't think we've done that yet.
Mine's at KVP Texas.
And I'm Hanks Kendall, Kendall with a Y, K-E-N-D-Y-L. And then, of course, there's Lady Lawyer Diary is the handle.
Is it diary or diaries?
So the hashtag is Lady Lawyer Diaries, and the name, the way the name is described is Lady Lawyer Diaries, plural, but the handle itself is Lady Lawyer Diary, singular.
Okay, good to know.
Perfect.
Well, thank you both for being here. It's been tremendous, and we're we're looking forward to, maybe we'll have you back to report in a few years, and we'll have a bunch of cultural change to talk about, we hope.
We might all still be stuck at home on Zoom, so we'll be.
Well, to our listeners, we say thanks for being with us today. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to your colleagues who you think might benefit from listening.
And taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great, too. We appreciate everybody who's rated us so far.
If you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.